Hello and welcome to Behind the Headlines, your Friday morning Utah news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Utah's members of Congress asked to meet with President Biden before he takes action on national monuments. Senate hopeful Becky Edwards says she wants to chart a moderate path in Washington and slams incumbent Mike Lee as too strident. And the high cost of housing is pushing many renters in Utah to a financial breaking point. Joining me for this conversation in studio, we've got Salt Lake Tribune editorial page editor George Pyle. Hello, George. Welcome.
Good morning. Nice to be back.
Yeah, you're the first guest I've had in studio in quite a while.
Taking my life in my hands.
Well, we're both fully vaccinated.
Yes. We're safe.
On the Zoom, we've got Tribune senior federal government reporter Matt Canham. Welcome and good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
And in addition to Matt, we have Taylor Stevens, government reporter with the Tribune as well. And welcome, Taylor. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Listeners, you can join with your questions or comments, the show that is. You can tweet them to at KCPW or call us 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. All right, I get the feeling we'll be talking about monuments a lot more over the next weeks. Matt Canham, Utah's entire federal delegation is seeking an audience with the president, President Joe Biden. This comes on the heels of news that we reported last week having to do with a report that was submitted. But why does the federal delegation en masse want to speak to President Biden?
Because they want to stop him from potentially enlarging Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, which is what anyone watching this expects to happen. Hmm. They have not been overly negative at this point. What they've been arguing for is that they want to have a legislative solution. They want a bill that sets the boundaries of these national monuments, and they want in that bill to remove a future president's power to change that decision. So that's what their goal is. What I would say is they don't have drafted legislation they're offering at this stage. Essentially, they want to extend this conversation, and they're worried the president can act, and the president can act whenever he wants to.
You know, we mentioned before or last week that Interior Secretary Deb Haaland had submitted a report including her recommendations for what should happen to the Bears Ears and the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments. Do we know what's in that report, Matt?
We don't at this stage. And what is clear from this letter is Utah's members of Congress do not know what's in that report either. Yep. As part of their letter to the president, they request that Secretary Haaland's report be released to Congress.
We can kind of assume what's in it, though, can't we? I mean, the stated aim of the Biden administration is to increase the size of these monuments, right?
You know, that's what the president talked about when he ran for office. I think it's a fair assumption that the secretary's recommendation is an expansion, but to how much? Is this back to where it was before former President Donald Trump reduced the monuments? Is it larger? You know, there's a lot of nuance that can go into how you expand these monuments.
Just quickly, isn't it kind of unusual for us to know that a review like this, the one that Secretary Haaland submitted, that it's been submitted? I guess, you know, we're kind of in unusual territory in general because we have this back and forth on monuments. But to know that there is a report that's been submitted, how do we know about that?
So we know about it in this case because it was part of a lawsuit. After Trump reduced the monuments, there were two separate lawsuits for each national monument that people who were engaged in these conversations, including tribal leaders, submitted. And as part of the government's response to those lawsuits, they mentioned that the secretary had submitted her report. One thing I'd say about national monument creation, which is a unilateral power of the president, is there is not necessarily a standard process. We've had former President Barack Obama, Secretary of the Interior, come visit before he named Bears Ears. So we knew that Sally Jewell submitted a report. And, you know, so we've had a little bit of this. We had Trump's Secretary of the Interior, Ryan Zinke, come out and make his recommendations. So we know, like, there is a little bit of a And sometimes we do get a sense of things are starting to move, but we know this one from a court case.
Yeah. At stake here is the monument status. Grand Staircase is a you know, a research monument, and we see a lot of dinosaur fossils coming out of it. The Bear's Ears Monument was requested by an intertribal coalition, five tribes. They wanted actually a bigger monument than they asked for. They asked President Barack Obama for, and then they saw what they did get significantly shrunk. The delegation, Utah's delegation in Washington, is in opposition to the restoration of the monuments. They want to do this through, as you said, legislation. A question that I have, Matt, is are they speaking on behalf of, you know, the public? Do we know where the public stands on this? I know that, for example, the San Juan County Council is now in favor of an expanded Bear's Ears National Monument, whereas before they weren't. But more broadly in Utah, do we know how Utahns feel about this?
That depends on who you ask and what the public is. We've seen elected leaders in San Juan County come out in favor of the restoration of Bear's Ears. Obviously, our federal delegation has long opposed the creation of national monuments here. Our governor is threatening to sue if they take action. And then there's people who say Utah's population does matter, but these are federal lands. These are owned by the United States of America.
Right.
And while Utah's elected leaders and its people should have some sort of influence, the decision is not solely ours.
Maybe that's a point to bring in George Pyle, editorial page editor and opinion columnist. You know, we're talking about the opinions of Utahns here, but as Matt Canham just alluded to, these are federal public lands, and I've heard you argue, George, that they're public lands with a capital P for a wider audience, obviously, than just Utahns. Go ahead.
Yes, I mean, people who are elected to public office in Utah refer to these as Utah public lands or Utah lands, and they are land and they are in Utah, but they belong to the United States of America. They have ever since we stole them from the Indians. And the idea that Utah has a veto on this is just absurd. The statute that admitted Utah to the Union specifically says that Utah declaims and it gives up any claim they have to any lands. Now, part of the history of this is that as people moved west, public lands often did become private lands. Sometimes in Homestead Act, 160-acre blocks, which they snuck through the Congress while the Southern senators were off in the Civil War. But at the further west you get, the less efficient that is. You can't make a stand on 160 acres in Utah like you can in Indiana. It's too dry. It's too rocky. So it remained federal land. It is still federal land. It is still the federal government's decision. It is polite and politic and diplomatic to ask Mitt Romney and Spencer Cox and Mike Lee what they think, but it's not their decision. It's the president's decision. Congress could make the decision if it would move, but it doesn't. Even we don't have a bill, and even if they offered a bill, it would still have to get through Congress, which represents all the other people who own this land, even if they live in Florida or Illinois. Mm-hmm. Dick Durbin in Illinois has always been a huge backer of the Red Rocks Wilderness Act and all these kinds of things, and is the best friend of environmentalists in Utah sometimes. So then some of Utah's congressmen introduced a bill to create wilderness land in Illinois just as kind of a shot to Durbin. Actually, I'd be okay with that. I think we need more wilderness everywhere. They ought to go ahead and do it. But if they can't get they say it ought to be a congressional decision, and I can see that, and it certainly is within the law and within the Constitution for Congress to stand up and say, no, this is the monument, or this is a park, or this is a recreation area, or this is a protected wilderness, or whatever. That's within their power and prerogative to do so, and they probably should do so to settle this. But I don't see it happening because only the congressmen from Utah seem to care.
Matt Canham, the president, President Joe Biden, is in Europe right now. But has there been any, you know, response from the White House in general on this request from Utah's delegation to meet over the fate of national monuments in the state?
Not that I'm aware of. And the timeline of when the president would act is really up in the air. You know, as you said, he's in Europe now on his first international trip. He's been really pushing infrastructure, and he wants a bipartisan bill there that includes help from Mitt Romney. I could see that it's possible the White House will have to calculate when they make this decision because of the ramifications that certain people, including Utah's members of Congress, will be upset.
You mean the political capital being expended and thereby losing some good graces with people he's trying to work deals with on things like infrastructure?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
And so we don't have a time frame, as you said. Do we know, just to wrap this topic up here, Matt, will the president, Secretary Holland came out here, will the president travel to Utah to redeclare these monuments, assuming that he does that? Is that the expectation?
You know, I don't know. He definitely could. I don't think it would be a requirement. You know, we've seen presidents handle this in different ways. Barack Obama did not come out here. So we'll see. And Bill Clinton did it in Arizona. So I don't know what's going to happen. It's possible, but I don't think it's a requirement.
Okay. Well, let me remind listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-8255, or you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. Let's zero in on a challenge that is being mounted to try to unseat one member of our federal delegation in next year's election. And Matt, this is a challenger for Senator Mike Lee, someone who has recently thrown her name in the hat. We talked about this a couple of weeks ago. Becky Edwards, the Tribune, and I'm assuming this is you for your reporting, Matt, spoke with her this week for a profile. And she says that Senator Mike Lee is too extreme for Utah, or she says that in as many words. She wants to go. Becky Edwards wants to go the moderate route, and that's kind of a reflection of who she is, a Republican moderate, right?
Yeah, it was an interesting talking to her. I talked to her outside of the at City Hall, where there was the pride display set up.
Yeah.
So she went to, you know, there she was watching her grandkids. She was a little distracted, and in between these, you know, people coming up and saying hi, she talked to me for a few minutes. And what was interesting in that conversation is just her general philosophy of what a U.S. senator should be. And essentially, her view is you take the biggest issues of the day, whether that's immigration, whether that's healthcare, whether that's infrastructure, and you craft the best possible compromise you can. You negotiate. You seek a bipartisan deal. The goal should be passing something. That has not been the way that Senator Mike Lee has represented Utah. It's not the way that many senators operate. And, you know, the idea that the goal is passing something is not always the case. For some of these people, the goal is stopping something from getting passed.
Or alternatively, appealing to voters, you know, policies not necessarily being front and center.
Right.
But getting reelected being front and center. This matchup, Matt Canham, like, you know, so much of everything these days revolves around the two candidates, Becky Edwards and Senator Mike Lee, you know, their positions over one particular person, former President Donald Trump, right? I mean, Becky Edwards was not a Trump supporter.
No, not at all. Becky Edwards encouraged people not to vote for Donald Trump in 2020, and she did not. She told me she voted for Joe Biden. So we have a Republican seeking the Senate nomination who actually voted for the Democrat who is our current president. She said that that was not the only time in her life she has voted for a Democrat for president, but that she has voted for far more Republicans than Democrats. She did not think that he is the right person to lead the country. She said that he should have been impeached after the January 6th attack at the U.S. Capitol. She is highly, highly critical of the president.
She is of the Mitt Romney camp then. I mean,
exactly.
Okay. There are, I mean, you talked about her voting for Democrats. There's also policy areas where she has, you know, aligned with policies that have been favored by Democrats, for example, Medicaid expansion, Matt Canham.
Yes. You know, that was one of her, direct criticism. I just asked her, name some policy areas in which you disagree with the senator. Where are the differences? And Medicaid expansion is one that she brought up. And if you remember, Medicaid expansion was a part of the Affordable Care Act, which was one of the most despised pieces of legislation if you're a Republican in our nation. And Utah only expanded Medicaid after a voter referendum was passed. And, you know, her take on that is she knows where the politicians stood on this proposal, but she said she also knew where Utah families did. And her argument is that the people of Utah were far more receptive of that as an issue than Republican office holders, and that she sided with those people.
Mm-hmm. I want to actually just we skipped over a point where I wanted to bring in George Pyle, the editorial page editor, because we were talking about the former president and the impeachment trial. And, you know, to a certain extent, that is all a reflection of also the attack on the electoral system. And George, you wrote this week in a column about a warning from scholars, a number of scholars in American academia who warned of a sort of threat to American democracy that is evolving out of this. Can you talk about that, George?
Yes, there was a statement of concern, and properly academic understatement, perhaps, given the rest of the text, warning us that American democracy is very much on the brink of going away. We have people who don't believe the results of the last presidential election that buy into the big lie of the Trump camp. We have, and which led to an violent insurrection at the Capitol. You know, something that Robert E. Lee never managed to do. We have states all over the country, most of them basically Republican states or Republican-controlled states, passing all kinds of legislation to make it harder to vote, not impossible, but more difficult. Finding every little place where they can take away early voting, make it illegal to give people food and water while they're waiting in line, stop the voting early voting on Sunday, where a lot of black churches load up the bus and all go to vote. They call it souls to the polls. They're trying to take away all these options. Some of these options were put in place as a response to the COVID pandemic to make it easier to vote so that people wouldn't all be crowded together on election day. Mm-hmm. But they worked very well. They increased voter turnout. And so many states, the election officials there, including some Republicans, thought, hey, that works pretty well. Let's keep those. More people vote. And there are a lot of election officials, people whose job that is, even many Republicans, including in Utah, who think my job is to get people to vote. Let's get more people to vote. But you have legislators and governors in those many states who, under the guise of keeping their elections pure and reliable, are coming up with all kinds of restrictions that make it harder to vote. Hmm. And nobody doubts what they're doing. They're trying to make it harder to vote. They're trying to make sure that black people and poor people and students and minorities and working people, it's just too hard for them to vote, so they just give up and they don't bother.
And George, there are two University of Utah, not University of Utah, but Utah scholars who signed this list of the scholars expressing a note of concern about the state of American democracy, and that it's at risk. Can you? I don't know if you're able to talk about who they are and why they did this.
Let me see. I gotta look that up. And I need new glasses.
You're fine. You don't have to dig into it right
here
now.
Here we are. Okay. Laura Gamboa, who is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Utah, was on the original list. And I think Stefan Blings from Utah State University joined later. And I was just looking this morning, and it looks like it's still only two from Utah out of more than 100 scholars nationwide. I contrasted that with the 100 scholars of marriage who tried to stop the marriage equality decision, and Utah was rather overrepresented on that list. We have less than 1% of the national population, and we had 13 of the 100 scholars of marriage who really kind of went down in flames. I mean, the Supreme Court didn't even mention their arguments. Even the dissenters didn't even appeal to the argument, which was basically that if you have gay marriage, you'll have a whole lot of unmarriageable women out there who will have lots of unfathered kids or have lots of abortions. And nobody took that seriously, the Supreme Court least of all.
We could keep lingering here. I'll urge people to check out George Pyle's column on the Scholars. It's an interesting column about the state of democracy. And Matt Cannon, maybe I can just come back to the Becky Edwards conversation on this front, which is you know, we pointed out that Becky Edwards is not in the Trump camp. I guess Senator Mike Lee, we know, he is his campaign chairman here in the state of Utah, but did he? Can you remind us where he stood when it came to, the idea that the election was stolen, the falsehood that there was election fraud?
He has not been as outspoken as many on this topic, but when it came down to January 6th, when members of Congress voted to accept the electoral votes of the states, Mike Lee did not object to the states of Arizona and Pennsylvania like many Republicans did. He accepted all of the electoral votes. So while he hasn't been as outspoken as, say, a Mitt Romney, calling what Trump has done a big lie, he has not taken any votes that are indicating that the election was stolen or anything like that.
Okay. He was actually rather eloquent that day on January 6th, saying, our job is to open and count. It really isn't our job to judge. And he took an original intent, plain language view of the Constitution, which he says he is generally in favor of, and stuck to it.
Matt, something just this is a profile that you did of Becky Edwards, and I want to keep getting through it. I mean, one thing that I've heard a lot about is that even before she announced her run, there were these attack mailers that went out, mailers trying to kind of head off her announcement or to, you know, head off her run against Lee. Tell us about these mailers.
So there's a group called Club for Growth, which has been a big supporter of Mike Lee throughout his two terms in office. And when you think about a race in a state like Utah, which is so Republican dominated, the real race is for the Republican nomination. The real race is now and then ends in June. After that, it is highly unlikely that whoever wins the Republican nomination will lose the general election. So you will we'll see a lot of money be spent early to protect Mike Lee from people like, or from groups like Club for Growth, who that support Mike Lee. You know, this is the way you, as an incumbent, the way you defend yourself is you raise a mountain of cash and you get supporters to beat up newcomers who are not as well known. And so I think anyone who runs against Mike Lee will get a similar experience.
Mm-hmm. Two paths to get on the ballot in Utah, you know, signature gathering or going through the convention route. You spoke with a political scientist who said that only one of those pathways was really a viable option for Becky Edwards. Why?
I think, obviously, if you're going to run against Mike Lee, who's one of the more conservative members of the Senate, the most likely path is to be more of a moderate, like Representative Edwards. And so if you do that, it's harder at convention, which attracts more conservative people. When she said that she voted for Joe Biden, that's not going to play well at a Republican convention. So while she is going to go and she is going to seek the nomination there, it is more likely that she'll get on the primary ballot by collecting signatures. So I think, you know, that she is going to do both. But I think Professor Burbank is right in saying that the signature path seems to be the most likely way for her to get on the ballot.
Okay. You know what? I think that in the interest of time, we will leave it there. And I will just say, Matt Canham, senior federal government reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks for your reporting on this. We're going to take a quick break in the show. And when we come back, we will turn to the affordable housing crisis and a crisis in, rental prices. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
This Week in This American Life. For lots of us, when we try to describe our siblings to people, we have a story we tell to illustrate what they're like. And Emmanuel's sister has a story like that about her.
It's not that flattering.
It's not that flattering.
No, I mean, it's just, It was just the time that you punched me in the eye. We were like...
Sisters and the very particular things that happened between them this week.
Saturday morning at 10 here on Utah Public Radio.
This is Carrie Bringhurst. We've been getting together in the mornings for quite a few years now. How about we mix things up a bit, and instead of meeting early in the day, we meet up in person where the locals eat for an evening meal. UPR's benefit dinner is back. That means we can meet and greet each other at a Logan restaurant the evening of Wednesday, June 23rd. And a portion of your meal purchase will support your favorite public radio station, Utah Public Radio. Details about times and location on our website, upr.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune senior federal government reporter Matt Canham, government reporter Taylor Stevens, and editorial page editor and columnist George Pyle. It's our live Friday morning Utah News Review, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255 or tweet to @KCPW. Well, after a long wait, we will bring in government reporter Taylor Stevens. And Taylor, this week you wrote about the housing crisis in Utah from a couple of different angles. One of your stories has to do with affordability. And we've talked a lot about soaring home prices, the value of homes going up in Utah. This story touches on that, but you describe a wider problem that is spilling over into the rental market. And many Utah renters are having a really hard time. Right, Taylor?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, you know, we've talked a lot about the impact the affordable housing crisis is having on people who want to buy a home. But we are finding that this current housing crisis we're in is also really impacting renters in a lot of different ways. And we have some data that shows that nearly one in five renters in Utah is severely cost burdened. And what that means is that they spend at least around half their income on housing. And, they kind of advise that you spend around 30% or less of your income on housing generally, so that you're able to pay all your other bills, all the other things that we all have to pay for to kind of make it in this world.
Yeah.
People who are spending that much money on housing, you know, they struggle sometimes to pay for food or transportation, other bills, pay down debt. And to have one in five renters in Utah facing these challenges is really striking.
You and your colleague Bethany Rogers spoke to a few people who are living that reality, people who are spending roughly half their income on housing. And I want to get to their stories, but there's some other parts of the statistics that I want to get to first, if possible. For example, something that mirrors the national trend, Taylor, is that if you earn minimum wage in Utah, there's really no way that you can afford an apartment, right?
Yeah. So there was an analysis from the National Low Income Housing Coalition that says a minimum wage worker in Utah would need to find a rental that costs $377 per month or less in order to be affordable. And we know, you know, anyone who's looked at any of the online apartment listings knows that is just not something that really exists right now. Maybe a bedroom in someone's house, but the average rent for one bedroom in Salt Lake right now is nearly $1,100 a month. And the other thing I want to mention about this data is that people of color in our community are much more impacted by these challenges, right, for a lot of different reasons and a lot of systemic challenges. But the research has found that 32% of Black renters in Utah spend more than half of their income on housing. And that's almost twice as likely to face a severe cost burden as white renters are. And so this is a challenge that we need to look at in a couple of different ways to really understand how it's impacting people in the community.
Right. And you spoke with a researcher at the Kemp C. Gardner Policy Institute at the University of Utah who reiterated that point. And then all of this, of course, plays into the homelessness crisis. I mean, if you're spending half your money on rent, you're not going to be able to save or as you said, pay for food. And then, you know, you don't have a safety net and so on and so forth. And so you are more likely to become homeless. And we can get to that as well. I mentioned the stories of people who are living the reality that this article portrays. And among them, Taylor, is a 74-year-old woman who is spending, I think, from what I understand, reading quite a bit more than half of her income, her Social Security check, that is, on rent. Can you talk about her story?
Yeah, and I also want to say that we talk to people across very different phases of their life. So right. Jan, 74-year-old, you mentioned, she lives in a senior living community in Sandy. You know, she is on Social Security. We also talk to people who are just starting out in their lives and a middle-aged mother who's struggling. So this is really affecting all facets and swaths of our community. For Jan in particular, she's paying $925 a month to live in a one-bedroom apartment in Sandy. And when I asked her what her income was, she knew her budget down to the cent. It's $1,251.80. And so, you know, she receives some government assistance to help pay for electricity, to help pay for food. She owns her car. She doesn't have too much debt. But, you know, that doesn't really leave much room for, you know, saving or, you know, going to see a movie or doing anything that, you know, is enjoyable and the things that bring enjoyment and excitement to our lives. You know, she worries that, you know, one thing could go wrong and she would not really have the money to deal with it. You know, she does have some savings because of the federal pandemic stimulus checks.
Yeah.
But if not for that, you know, she would have a very little social safety net to fall back on. And so, you know, it's really scary for her to see the rent going up and she's trying to find something else. But, you know, as we talked about earlier, there's just nothing available in kind of her price range, $800 to $900 a month. Those apartments, when they do exist, go really fast.
You just mentioned something, the rental. I mean, you said rental increases. That's a reality that she faced, you know, I think a couple of times. And I think that your profile here in various places, there's another woman who just has seen some repeated raises in rent. Rent is going up, but wages, they aren't necessarily going up. I guess, are you able to talk about that? And also maybe, Taylor, I don't know if you can do this, but the rules that govern when landlords can increase the rent, it's a big topic to open up. But I guess maybe we could start with the fact that wages are stagnant and prices are going up.
Yeah, and this is something that my colleague Tony Semerad has done a lot of reporting on. State lawmakers recently received a briefing about this issue that, you know, there's shrinking paychecks, a shortage of homes also increases, but Utah's median incomes have stayed pretty much flat since 2002, even though the economy is doing really well. And so that, you know, people are pointing to as potentially an issue. Rents have risen, but, you know, wages really haven't. As for the raises for rent, that is kind of a complicated issue that depends on your lease. Typically, you know, if you sign a lease, then if you have a year lease, you know, maybe renegotiate things once that lease is done. People who have a month-to-month lease, of course, have fewer protections in that regard. But a lot of times, I know for the woman that is that we spoke to, mm-hmm. Anna,
yeah.
who is a single mom who lives in an income-restricted apartment complex in Holiday. She receives disability benefits, and she has seen her rent go up. And for her, she is seeing that happen kind of when her lease is going up. And so really hours after we spoke with Anna, she sent me an email and said that her rent, she'd received a notice on her door that her rent was being increased again as her lease was kind of, you know, coming to its end, and that she was going to have to pay $1,100, kind of that market rate now, starting July 1st. And so a lot of people are just seeing, you know, at every time their rent can be increased that it has been over the last few years, but they're maybe not seeing their income. And obviously that isn't the case for Anna because she's on kind of a fixed income, but for those who are in the workforce, maybe not seeing their wages increase as often as their rent is.
You know, one thing that struck me from your profile of Anna was that she was fearful of retribution, basically, for talking about her landlord and rental costs, and so the Tribune withheld her surname. And I mean, this kind of points to the landlord holding the keys to people's ability to, you know, obviously to keep a roof over your head, but also when there is so much demand, I guess you want to be very, very careful with how you treat your landlord. It's just it's an interesting dynamic, obviously an unequal dynamic, Taylor. I don't know how to, it's not much of a question.
Well, I think Utah is a state that doesn't have many protections for renters. And, you know, for folks who are really struggling, you know, your housing is so important. And we talked to a lot of people who were afraid, you know, please don't put the name of my apartment complex in the story. And most people were comfortable enough to give us their name. And we did decide to withhold Anna's last name because we felt that her situation was really important and that her story was really important, but, you know, just a very vulnerable situation. And we definitely don't want to put her in a situation where she loses her housing. You know, we want to do no harm. And so that's kind of how we approach that decision. But I do think it speaks to that, that power dynamic and those, you know, fears that people can have around losing their housing, a very vulnerable thing.
I want to bring George Pyle, the editorial page editor and columnist, into this, but, you know, against all of this is the background of homelessness. And Taylor, I want to turn to a story that you wrote about that just after this. But we're not tackling everybody's story who you profiled in the piece in the Tribune that I encourage people to check out. And I encourage them to check out the reporting we're about to turn to. But is there anything big from this story, Taylor, that we're missing before that we haven't touched on yet before we turn to George Pyle here?
Yeah, I just want to reiterate that this is impacting people in a lot of different phases in their lives. We talked about, you know, two of the people on fixed incomes, but we also spoke to a recent college graduate who says she's foregoing mental health and other, you know, medical needs in order to save money because she is paying a lot of money on rent. And also, you know, a 30-year-old professional that we spoke with who is putting off buying his house because he can't seem to get enough money together for a down payment, and in the meantime is spending a lot of money on rent. And so this is impacting a lot of people in the community, and I think evidenced by the response that we saw online and in the comments, some of the feedback I've gotten. So really important issue, and we really appreciate the people who spoke to us to help, you know, us understand this issue better.
Thanks, Taylor. George Pyle, editorial page editor, columnist with the Tribune. Home prices, that is, going up, housing costs, stagnant wages. I guess what's to be done, George Pyle?
Well, I think we've proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that the free market is incapable of solving this problem. If it could, it would have. We talk about... They talk about building a new apartment complex, and with some kind of government subsidy or something, they promise that there will be some units at market rates and some units at affordable rates. In an economy that works for people, market and affordable are the same thing. In our economy, we have to keep defining the difference. There's what the market will bear, and there's what people can afford. And when those are different, there is a problem that needs to be dealt with. The legislature, the city council, the county council have made some efforts here and there, have recognized the problem. As often is the case in Utah, it's the rich philanthropists who have stepped up to the plate as much or more than any government agency. They are looking to use some of the federal stimulus money and things for that. But if they're not, they had to be dragged to expanding Medicaid, which affects housing. They won't even dream of raising the minimum wage for fear that the price of a Big Mac might go up 8 cents. They just no sympathy for people who aren't connected and tied in and make political contributions. The legislature, I mean, not more so in Utah necessarily than anywhere else, but the legislature obviously has the backs of the landlords, not the tenants. I mean, a landlord-tenant operation is generally a power dynamic that is in favor of the landlord, no matter where you are. But with stagnant wages, total lack of concern for working class people unless they become homeless and camp out in your front yard, this is just not working. The state, the city, the county, the philanthropic community has got to step up a lot more, raise wages, subsidize housing in some way, provide a lot more affordable housing, and then looking at all kinds of things, tiny houses made out of shipping containers, You know, I'm, you know, all of the above, but they've really got to get after this, or it's just, it's not going to get better. And the landlords, to some degree, are going to have to accept some sacrifice, too, or we're just going to have people with nowhere to live.
That's George Pyle, who is editorial page editor with the Tribune. We're going to take another quick break in the show, and yeah, when we come back, more from this past week in Utah news, and also your underplayed stories of the week. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Stay with us.
Next time on The Pulse, Adnan Khan could picture what was happening inside of prisons as the coronavirus spread and people were getting sick.
You start yelling, or you have your cellmate yell, "Man down, man down."
And he also knew that healthcare and prison are often at odds.
Ultimately, the people that make the decisions are correctional staff.
Incarceration, health, and the lasting impact.
Friday morning at 10 on Utah Public Radio.
I'm Dr. Susan Madsen, founding director of the Utah Women in Leadership Project at Utah State University. In partnership with Utah Public Radio, we are relaunching and expanding our Utah Women in Leadership podcast series. We'll share research and resources about topics like imposter syndrome, gender and race, the impact of COVID-19 on Utah women and work, body image challenges, and more. Listen at utwomen.org or on your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Taylor Stevens, and George Pyle. This show is a Friday morning local news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio, featuring reporting from the pages of the Salt Lake Tribune. Join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-TALK or tweeting to at KCPW. We left off talking about the housing crisis, and now I want to turn to homelessness. And we won't, I don't think, be able to do this particular story justice because some of it has to be seen. Taylor Stevens, you and a Tribune photojournalist set out to document homelessness in Utah County. And the imagery and layout for the story is really remarkable. I encourage people to check it out at sltrib.com. But maybe just to begin with, tell us about this project, because I understand that it's just the start of a sort of focus on homelessness in Utah County. Taylor.
Yeah, so we have, this is a kind of our kickoff, as you mentioned, of some reporting on homelessness in Utah County. We've been traveling the state over the last few weeks, doing some reporting on homelessness in areas beyond Salt Lake County. I'm actually in St. George right now doing some reporting on homelessness there. We'll have some reporting from around the state, just trying to help people understand what homelessness looks like in some of these communities where the issue doesn't get as much attention as in Salt Lake City. So that's kind of what you can expect from in the next couple of weeks to see more on this issue in areas around the state.
Well, and one of those stories about Utah County came out this morning. It's the fact that this is a county that does not have a shelter for the homeless, but homelessness is happening nonetheless. Do we have a firm idea of you know, the numbers on homelessness in Utah County, Taylor?
Yeah, so every year across the state, communities do an annual census of the homeless population. It's known as the point in time count. And it's not a perfect measure because, you know, some people are couch surfing, some people are hard to find. And so it is generally accepted that the numbers are quite a bit higher than the point in time count reflects.
Okay.
I believe that the 2020 point in time count, we don't quite have the numbers for this year's count yet, was around 140 people experiencing homelessness in the Utah County area. And they have, I believe, 58 beds they had available that night. As you mentioned, they don't have a shelter for people experiencing homelessness. And so it's a real struggle to, you know, help people get off the streets and help people find access to shelter who want it.
Why are there no homeless shelters in Utah County? I guess maybe that's a big question to ask, but can you answer that, Taylor?
Yeah, we try to get to that question in the story that published today, me and my colleague Bethany Rogers, and it comes a lot down to a couple things. One, political opposition. It's pretty well agreed among a lot of service providers and advocates. So there just isn't the political will to build a shelter. For one part, a lot of people have this idea that if you build a shelter, then people will come from, you know, around the country to it. And there is some truth to that. We have seen, you know, the Salt Lake shelters, for example, help people from across the country. St. George's shelter helps people from all over the United States. But it does kind of ignore the reality that there already are enough people experiencing homelessness in the area that could fill a shelter right now, even without one. So that's one piece of the puzzle. Another piece of the puzzle, though, and we'll have a little bit more reporting on this next week, is that Utah County has really approached their homelessness challenge by trying to get people into permanent supportive housing. And so they believe that getting people into housing is the ultimate way to end homelessness. That's the ultimate goal. And so rather than putting their resources toward what you would call emergency shelter, they want to put their resources toward permanent housing. And so kind of just a different focal point. But, you know, there's disagreement about whether there should be one or not. But everybody does seem to agree that it would be challenging to bring one to the community because of the politics and sensibilities in the area.
And the sort of political will to do it or to not do it or to, yeah, again, as you said, focus resources elsewhere. Again, I want to encourage people to check out the story that you wrote that is this interactive, I don't know how to describe it, photojournalism montage with writing that you did, reporting that you did, where you speak with a number of homeless people in Utah County. You can find that at sltrip.com. This is just sort of an interesting fact, but a number of the people that you spoke to said that they would be very willing to go to a shelter, correct, if there was one that existed there.
Yeah, I think that we have to remember that people experiencing homelessness are not a monolith. And so there are people who prefer camp for a variety of reasons, but there also are people who don't want to be sleeping on the streets. They don't want to be harassed by police. They are trying to get back on their feet and they need a place to go. And so, you know, we spoke to people who kind of run the gamut. Some people who said, you know, I wouldn't go to a shelter if there is one, I'm not interested in that. And others who said, yeah, I would go. There's nowhere else for me to go. The police are, you know, harassing me, moving me around because camping is illegal in the Provo area. So definitely, I think there is interest from people experiencing homelessness in the community for some kind of shelter. And I would just put in another plug for the beautiful photos. Photojournalist Trent Nelson has really done a great job of capturing, you know, a community that is very invisible in the Provo and Utah County area. And I think something that a lot of people aren't aware is even a challenge because so many people sort of hide out and try to, you know, stay out of the way so they don't get camping tickets or get picked up by police. So a lot of people in Utah County aren't aware this is a problem in their community. And I think the photos do a really great job of showing that, you know, there is a problem in the community.
Yeah. Happy Valley not being so happy for everybody. George Pyle, editorial page editor, columnist. We tend to talk a lot about homelessness. One of the things that I really appreciate about Taylor's reporting here is, and generally, is getting the perspective of people who are struggling and how they ended up where they are and what they're trying to do about it. But I don't know if you want to dig into the homeless shelters idea in Utah County. You know, Taylor pointed to politicians talking about if you build it, they will come, and that being something that they want to discourage. What do you say to that argument?
Well, I think the experts and the people who really care in Salt Lake County would also agree that housing first, getting people into more or less permanent supportive housing, is a better option than shelters. And what we did here was we tore down the old shelter, which was basically just keep people from freezing to death and starving to death and nothing else, and tore that down, moved to what they called service centers. The idea is that people would move through these service centers. They wouldn't just stay there, and they wouldn't just sleep there and spend the rest of the day on the street. We would get them housing eventually. And if Utah County is able to be successful in skipping the shelter step and skipping the service center step and going right to permanent supportive housing, then they will have cracked a big nut that will help this a lot and won't locate all the homeless people in one place, which frightened, you know, Egon, you're scaring the straits, and make it difficult to locate these things. Because if you just have a lot of apartments scattered all over the place, some of which are occupied by people who last week were homeless, then you don't have the problem, or you can hope you don't have the problem, of the not in my backyard syndrome, where people are scared of the homeless like they're Martians or something.
Hmm. I will encourage people, again, to check out Taylor's reporting on this. Thank you, George, for your comments. And I'm sorry that we've burned through the hour and already have to turn to that final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And we've had Matt Canham on mute for quite a while. Matt, why don't we turn to you for the first pick for underplayed story?
I'm going to be a little self-serving and pick one of my own stories that just posted this morning.
Yeah.
About, you can see it on sltrib.com. It is about Utah's declining fertility rate and the number of births has dropped. Last year, Utah had the same number of births they had in 1999, even though the state's growing fast. This is a national trend. It is an international trend. And declining births may at some point really change how our society operates. So we talked to a family about some of this. We talked to some demographers and Senator Mitt Romney about how he wants to change legislation.
He wants to pay parents to for
exactly.
Okay. Check that out at sltrip.com. Thank you, Matt Canham, for your pick for underplayed story of the week. George Pyle, let's go to you back here in studio before we turn to Taylor Stevens. How about for your pick?
Well, no matter how much play we give this story, it's going to be underplayed. We're on fire. I mean, we've had a drought that's just of geologic proportions. It ain't raining. It ain't going to rain. Climate change or no climate change, and it's dry and it's hot, and everybody who's out there is going to have to be aware of this. No matches, no target shooting, and please no fireworks.
All right.
We just can't handle it.
George Pyle with a plea to the public. Thank you, George. Taylor Stevens, back to you on the Zoom. Your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Well, it's kind of remarkable to me that you have someone in studio today and that we haven't uttered the words COVID-19 yet.
True.
I'm going to break that, though, and point to a story from my colleague, Erin Alberti. She wrote about who is still dying from COVID-19. As we know, Utah adults have been eligible for the vaccine for months, and she looks at some of the data to find out who is still vulnerable, who's vaccinated, who's not, and who's still dying. So it's worth a read. Although I'm sure we're all sick of the COVID news.
Yeah, sick of COVID news, but it's not. We're not out of it yet. Thanks for that pick. And George, I'm sorry, I'm going to cut you off. I'm going to go just because we have little time left. I will issue my pick for underplayed story of the week, which is that opponents of the Utah Inland Port held a press conference yesterday to decry the construction of a transloading facility and some deals struck with ports in California. Leah Larson has reporting on that at sltrib.com. And also, the Utah Jazz aren't underplayed, but they're doing really well. Go Jazz.
Go Jazz.
Go Jazz. That does it for Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. I want to thank George Pyle, Matt Canham, and Taylor Stevens, all with that paper, for joining us. Thanks you guys, for being here virtually and in person.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Of course. Behind the Headlines is a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. You can find podcasts at kcpw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Find all of the coverage that we've been discussing today over at sltrib.com. I'm Roger McDonough. Have a great weekend and join us again next week.
Support for Utah Public Radio programming comes from our members and Utah Festival Opera and Musical Theater, presenting 33 variations. Discovering why Beethoven was compelled to write 33 distinct variations on a simple theme by a minor music publisher. Information at utahfestival.org. Coming up next is The Pulse here on Utah Public Radio during our UPR Presents Hour. Stay with us.
A service of the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Utah State University, this is Utah Public Radio. Heard statewide on KUSR, Logan, KUSK, Vernal, KUSL, Richfield, KUST, Moab, KCEU, Price, and KUSU-FM, Logan.